The EMS Garage is a production of EMSRadio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage.
You guys there? Can you hear me?
Oh, we can so hear you, Chris. It's Bring Your Own Topic Night, the week before EMS Expo, when we're at the Zoll podcasting booth. They're at what we think is we have three booths at EMS Expo. We really don't know why, but we're near the food. And that's all you need to know. So when you're at EMS Expo, walk toward the food. You'll see our booth, and we're right there. Zoll Podcasting booth. And I'll be there. Jamie Davis. I think Kyle David Bates will be there. But don't tell him, because he will be there.
Where?
You'll be at Expo, I've heard. Greg Fries will be there. A few other, minor EMS celebrities will be there. And we're happy to see you when you come by. So come by the booth. We'll give you free stuff all day. And I heard that there might be a contest with Zoll, and it's worth a lot of money. And that's all I'm going to tell you right now, but you have to listen to the show every day if you want to know what's going on. So listen to our show at EMS Expo every day, emsgarage.com, or you can go on to Ustream and watch us streaming live, or you can just find Jamie Davis and say, "Hey dude, how do I get that free money?" And we will help you out. Apparently, Chris has dropped out, so I'm going to drop him back in here. There we go. I'm Chris Montero, Geeky Medic on all the websites. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter and everything else. Joining me first is Mr. Ben Hoffman, all the way from New Zealand. Hello, sir.
Hey, Chris, what's going on? Dude, I have to work again tonight. And once again, I'm not sleeping. I'm here talking to you fine people. And
yes.
I just the best.
Yes, we're so happy to have you, and along with your sarcasm, because sarcasm was great last week, so we really appreciated that.
Thank you so much, my pleasure.
No problem. And this week I have a cold, so if I'm sniffing in the mic, sorry about that. Also joining us tonight, Mr. Kyle David Bates.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Just waiting to kick your butt down there, because I heard you called me out on last week's podcast, mister.
It was 2 weeks ago, but I still called you out, because, dude, you lost last time.
It was a lucky shot. I wasn't paying attention to
the
numbers.
It was more than a lucky shot. I beat you on like two consecutive shots.
You did not. Nice try.
On your home turf. On your home turf.
Seriously. Man.
It was on your home turf.
Oh, is it Wednesday night we're going to do it?
Wednesday night we're going to do it at some point after the blog meetup thing. That's what I've heard.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have to rope off the area, have referees and police on standby.
Right on. Okay.
I'll bring the Kleenex.
Apparently, you apparently have a few people on your team. I have some of the best. I have Ann, and I have Brad Buck, and I have Jamie Davis.
I got Scott Keir.
Okay. And?
I've got Chris Mitchell. And I'm going to work on Brad there, because he's liking photographs for his blog. So, Brad, we may have to do some wheeling and dealing here.
But, Brad, remember the photographs I have of you that maybe really shouldn't be released. So, just saying.
He's quiet.
And that voice you hear is Mr. Brad Buck. Hello, sir.
Good evening, Chris.
How are you?
I'm wonderful, thank you.
Good. Also joining us tonight is Mr. David Koenig, all the way from the Bronx, New York.
Queens.
Oh, Queens. God, I get you and Chris mixed up. Chris is from the Bronx. You're from the Queens. Sorry. Well, how you been?
Good. I got my Five Guy Burger and Fries, Mellow Yellow. I got my Blackjack gum, and I got that feeling that there's something rank going on in EMS.
That sounds good, dude. Five Guy Burger. Oh.
Yeah, it was wrong. Quite excellent, especially after the gnarled traffic at the UN today.
Gotcha. Well, you know, one of my favorite cities in all of the United States is New York City. I love it. Love it, love it, love it.
And it loves you.
I know, it should. I've been there a few times, and I can't wait till the next time I go back. So, anyway, maybe next time I'll, you know, you can hook me up with a sweet Five Guys burger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right on.
Let me know.
Cool. Also joining us tonight is Mr. James Warmoth, all the way from the lovely state of Texas. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Like, completely the opposite of New York.
Bigger and slower.
Come on, dude. I'm totally calling you out, and you didn't even say anything. You just kind of went, huh? Oh, right. You have a new kid. So you're, like, really tired. James, dude, you're not even there tonight. Man.
Oh, I'm here. I'm
okay,
here.
You're just really tired. I can
well,
tell.
I don't know what's going on, but my Skype screen keeps lighting up like people are trying to talk, but nothing actually gets said. So it looks on my end like there's a bunch of people talking, but nothing's being, I'm not hearing anything.
Sometimes that's our podcast, so that's okay.
It's true, yes.
Also joining me tonight is Mr. Tim Noonan, all the way from Pennsylvania. Hello, sir.
I'm doing okay. I'm missing New York right now myself.
I know. Who wouldn't miss the good food in New York?
Well, man. I like this pizzeria right next to Yonkers Raceway that does chicken marsala slices. Oh. Those are excellent.
Hey, have you guys ever been to Carnegie Hall? Or Carnegie... It's like a...
I don't
not
practice.
Carnegie Hall, but not, it's like Carnegie Deli.
Carnegie Deli.
Oh, my Carnegie gosh. Deli. The best pastrami sandwich I've ever had in my entire life. Oh, so good. I couldn't
pastrami,
eat it all.
Pastrami, corned beef, and tongue sandwiches.
Oh, not tongue, but... Pastrami. Yeah. I don't need tongue.
That's awesome. Just
the sandwiches are huge, like ridiculously huge, if I remember right.
It's monster. I mean, if you have a... If I remember right, it's at least a foot of pastrami. At least a foot. And it's so big, you can't eat it with your hands. You have to eat it with a fork. And then the hot mustard and a big pickle. Oh, my gosh. That's so good.
But people from out of town eat it with a fork.
Yeah, well, you know.
New Yorkers eat it with their hands.
Yeah, because we're, you know, us Coloradans are tiny. You can't eat it, you know.
That's right.
Oh, and that other voice you hear is Mr. Chris Sarabello. Hello, sir. Gosh,
okay.
I want to call you like a brain. I can never figure it out. So either Cerebello or Cerebrum. I cannot figure it out.
I'll take them all, man. Just all give right. me what you got.
But we'll see you next week at Expo, and that's what I'm happy about.
You will, yeah. We'll be. I'm actually in Texas now and getting ready for the show.
Oh, that's right. You're with your wife. Sweet. Well, we'll see you in a couple
that's
days.
Right. I hope so. I hope she's mine.
You hope you're
otherwise,
with your wife.
I have a lot of explaining.
Oh, sorry. I didn't want to call you out on the podcast. Sorry about that. He's apparently maybe with his wife on this night. Anyway, we won't tell what night we're recording, so that'll be better for you.
No, actually, I came to Texas a little early. My son had his first boy, so I guess I'm officially a grandfather.
Oh, my gosh, dude.
7 pounds. Yep. 7 pounds. Quarter ounce. His name is Alexander Ryan, and it was a good distraction to come home a little bit early and hang out with the family and, you know, kind of play grandpa a little bit. And it's great. I'm already planning on feeding the kid chocolate and some Red Bull and sending him home. So it's going to work out.
Congratulations, man. Oh, my gosh. You know, that's I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast before, but a few years ago, well, not even a few years ago, about a year and a half ago, I was hankering for another kid, realizing that my kids now are 16 and 12. And my wife's like, seriously? She's like, we're not doing that again. Wait for grandkids. So I really envy you right now. And I really, I just can't wait for grandkids. They're so cute. Oh, babies are so cute. You just want to kiss their cheeks. It's awesome.
And right? It was really great. You know, the kid was here and I started to cry. So I told my son to take him home.
Right. Well, don't take him home. Just spoil him and then send him back. That's what my parents told me. We just spoil our kids and then send them back. So that's good. So first topic tonight, because since I own the podcast or whatever, and I get to bring my own topic first, I wanted to talk about a topic that came up on gems.com today. And it was about a councilman in Mississippi that said, Councilman suggests that ambulance crews should ignore safety. Apparently, there was a gentleman that was shot and waited over 20 minutes for help to arrive. Even though the ambulance was ready, they had to wait for the police to get in and clear the scene, which is absolutely appropriate for most of us in EMS to do. But this councilman says, no, not so fast. We should probably be rushing in and hope that people aren't shooting at us and hope that people don't die. That is my oh, duh moment of the week. And good job, AMR, that you didn't, that your crew didn't run into the scene and cause more victims than were necessary. So, other thoughts?
Does this go back to what we were saying about public safety versus patient care? That the councilman feels that that we should be running in kind of like the fire department, not to put the fire department down, but, you know, risk a lot to save a lot versus, you know, is it safe for us to approach? Is it safe for us to go in and to actually take care of the patient?
He wants us running in like the Three Stooges.
Hello, hello, hello. I just see a bunch
hello.
Of... I just see a couple of paramedics sticking their head around the corner. Hello, hello, hello. Like the old Three Stooges anyway. That's funny. Other thoughts? Apparently everybody agrees. I don't know. It's bring your own topic. Come on.
Well, it depends on what you read. There was one article that was linked to where the guy from AMR produced their dispatch times, on-scene time, and patient contact time, and it's a total of 7 minutes, 25 seconds. Now, do you believe the guy from AMR, or do you believe the councilman? So I did a little bit of research, and it turns out that this councilman does not have a good reputation. He's been investigated by the local paper for taking trips everywhere, spending taxpayer money to get there, and he says, well, it's okay that I don't make most of the meetings because I only go to the essential ones. The other ones don't count. Yet he wants EMS to go running into scenes because the high-paid job of EMS is worth taking a few bullets for just to protect him so he can shoot his mouth off. Not that I have an opinion on it.
And then the thought goes, too, is you know, we really have to start educating these guys on what we really do and how we do our job and why it's important. It seems that, you know, every time that there's a point to be made, you know, a lot of people are making points about EMS when they really don't have the knowledge of what they're talking about. And as a group, we've got to be able to get together to say, you know, guys, I think this is the real story, and get some of these people behind it. You know, they make these comments about safety or whatever they're making comments about. Who's getting on the phone with them to send them straight after the fact or with the newspaper to say, you know, let's put our own spin or let's give you our side of the story? And I don't think we do that well enough in our career field.
That's something which we're definitely lacking. We're definitely lacking the ability to put out there what we actually do and educate people. And in a situation like this, and I read a couple of different stories too, you know what? If the ambulance crew got 3 blocks away and police weren't on scene and they parked the 2 blocks or the 3 blocks away waiting for PD to get on scene and secure the scene before going actually on scene and making patient contact, I wouldn't have a problem with that, waiting those 20 minutes. If I was the councilman, though, I would be asking why it took the police 20-plus minutes to respond.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
You know, yeah, I mean,
he doesn't want to spend money on cops. He's saving taxpayers' money.
No, it's not about saving taxpayers' money, but he's going against the path of least resistance, which is, If I call out the police, I'm going to have, you know, the PBA and the chief and, like, all these people up in arms. If I call out the EMS service, it's AMR. It's a private company. Everybody hates EMS, and they're not going to speak up for themselves. And that's the perception that a lot of politicians and officials have about EMS. And, you know, I still look at the situation over the winter with Pittsburgh EMS. With their situation, and, you know, their public safety director, quote unquote, steamrolled over them, and you didn't hear boo from them.
Well, one place did post some video from the city council meeting in Pittsburgh that was presenting a different story from what you got in the newspapers. The third crew that got canceled was shoveling its way through. They were the ones who got closest to the resident when they were told by dispatch to cancel.
Right,
yeah, but you would believe this clown who was city councilman or public safety director, and he's saying, oh, no, we're just going to sit here and do nothing because we don't want to do anything. Instead, they're going from that call to another call to another call. They were working nonstop that day, and because one person said something inappropriate on the phone, he's got to make a big deal out of it, like he was doing something other than partying at a vacation resort at the time.
Right, but that came out in April, that video. And this is something that happened in February. Similar to this incident, this incident happens today. And what has really been the response from EMS? You know, I mean, besides the EMS bloggers, so to speak, has anyone else ever responded on behalf of EMS? I haven't read anything.
Well, David, I mean, even thinking your question, though, who out there is to respond to that? Who do we have representing our career field as going to be the voice to say this is wrong? And, you know, we constantly say those things about we need to get our stories out. They need to understand us, you know, so on and so forth. But who's that group? Who's going to do that? And we really don't have that representation.
There's no reason why we need to have a central group like that. And, you know, the police department, you know, doesn't have a real centralized group like that. The fire department does. They have the IAFF, which will turn around and do that. You know, local or agencies have these groups. So the local agency for that jurisdiction should hopefully have some sort of group or have some sort of mechanism in place to respond to these allegations. And
National Association, you know, of EMTs?
Well, you know, if it truly was a National Association of EMTs, then yeah, ideally, sure, that would be a great example. But that's something which, you know, it has, well, anyway.
It's what they should be doing.
Right. Yeah, it's what they should be doing instead of what they are doing. And,
okay, well, wait,
you know,
whoa. But the National Association of EMTs aren't a union, and IAFF is a union. So, I mean, I would be careful in the space, because I think that NAEMT, for all the good that they do for the, you know, the PHTLS courses they teach, that's it. There's nothing. They don't really advocate for employee rights. They advocate to keep their mission going, which is to teach classes. So just wanted to make sure we leveled the ground there.
I think there's other things, though. But I think there's other things that NAEMT does, and I like to think I'm very active with NAEMT, and they do come out with position statements, and they do support the workers. And but I, you know, when you talk about the power of a union, you know, International Firefighters Association, and the fear is always, you know, we're going to pull our guys off the job if we don't set things straight. And but I think that if an organization is going to stand up, such as NAEMT, there really needs to be representation of a group that is able to stay up on these things and is able to, you know, there's a lot of people that work with NAEMT, and they're all volunteers, and they're all running in their own systems, and they're all educators. But I think there needs to be a group, you know, of EMS leaders that are kind of monitoring that, and then maybe with the behalf of the organization to say we need to address this on behalf of our career field.
Yeah, but this is something that needs to be done by like a union, or I mean, for that matter, NAEMT does have their mission, and their goal is to teach classes, and I think that's something which they could definitely expand their mission. But, you know, this is something that could be done within an agency. But EMS agencies don't put enough emphasis or prioritize being able to respond to these types of things so that when these things do happen, they're not prepared.
But, you know, I got to say, and I'm listening to this, I'm reading the blog, I'm reading the announcements, this is one guy who, by reputation, is not well respected. Why are we even giving him this much time? You know, the same thing happened down in Florida with a guy that wanted to have a special day on November 11th. You know, we've taken one little stupid thing said and we've blown it up. How many times does this happen on a weekly basis that we're being criticized to this about this situation? And I agree with you that we need to sit up and say, but sometimes we need to just kind of sit back and let that person just bury themselves because that's all they're going to do. And I would almost guarantee that, you know, AMR is looking at this and the PIO person is looking at this as saying, hey, the way you're talking, keep going, because you're just making yourself sound just as dumb as everybody, you know, everyone thinks you are.
Well, with the guy in Pittsburgh, that should have been the result. Instead, he comes out of it without being investigated, without being fired, without being strung up from a tree someplace. And he is the problem. The city was not prepared for a blizzard because he decided two-wheel drive trucks, they make great snowplows. Actually, it's a one-wheel drive truck. But, you know, that's beside the point. This guy, if enough people listen to him and he doesn't get the slapdown that he deserves, then people are thinking, yeah, he has a point. They don't know. How would they know? And if the NAEMT is only getting money to run classes, why should anybody join? I could join the American Heart Association and see if they have a membership because they do classes. This is what the NAEMT should be doing.
And I think they take a side, you know, and again, to be an advocate for an EMT, they do take a lot of sides for the EMTs and the paramedics that work in the field. I think there could be an expanded scope. And, you know, based on that, you know, I'm going to head and take the charge, and we're in Dallas next week and, you know, talk to Pat Moore and, you know, Pam Lane and see if there's something that a group of us can get together to do that maybe with the backing of NEMT. And I don't even know if that's possible, but we'll give it a shot and we'll try and we'll ask the questions. And but we all have to stand up and, you know, Tim, I'm with you on, you know, how much time do we want to give to a guy. But, he's just one person in a long line of disrespect that our career field gets. And until someone is able to stand up to say, you know what, we're a little bit more than this, and, you know, let us do our jobs and respect us as a career field, you know, we're just going to continue. It doesn't matter that it's this guy. It's going to be someone in the West next. It's going to be someone in the South. So it's just going to keep happening.
I think every community has this. Every community has this guy, you know, and I think sometimes the media really got hold of this one down there, and then, you know, the internet and social media really took off quite a bit for us. But the community that I'm currently serving, I'm sure that this person in some way, shape, or form does exist. Maybe he's just not quite as vocal. The media doesn't get hold of it. But I think we've all either had to deal with this type of a situation or at some point in time, we will have to deal with this situation.
Well, my thought on the issue is going back to what I said last week. And, well, first of all, it sounds like this guy isn't the most reputable character out there. But then again, look who's talking. I probably shouldn't have said that, man. Now, seriously, though, but, like, how much of this is the public perception and the reality are two different things? Look, I've done a lot of things, and I know that the public, their perceptions of what they want and what they need for themselves are really two different things. We had a situation here about 18 months ago, the exact same thing. A convenience store owner got shot, and the police and the armed defenders squad turned up, and they had an ambulance crew sitting down the road, and the same thing was said. The family were on TV saying it took 20 minutes for the ambos to attend to the patient. And I can't remember from memory how long it took, but it was basically the same thing. It was until the armed defenders squad had turned up and made the scene safe, they weren't going in. And I think within a day, we had the regional operations manager on TV saying, this is why we sat down the road, because it's not safe. And, I mean, I'm wondering how much of it is the public's perceiving, oh, the Ambos should just, you know, should just go and treat this guy because he's dying, and how much of it is, look, do you, you know, I don't want to go into a scene that's not safe, and you, that would be my take on it as to whether or not the public are actually aware enough of what goes on out there in the street, in the real world, and it doesn't sound like they are, once again.
Look at confined space rescue. The problem is people go into a situation that isn't safe. Then you have more people who need to be rescued. It's the same thing in a shooting situation. You're creating more of a problem by rushing in when it is not safe. And this guy is a complete idiot. He needs to have that pointed out loudly on TV, where everybody who's heard him mouth off can hear that he is a complete idiot, and then maybe they'll understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite obvious that the guy's a dickhead, but look, I mean, you are right, Tim, that it's the first thing you learn. The first thing you learn is to throw your hands in the air and go, ooh, BSI, scene safe, scene safe. And yeah, it's no good sending people into a scene where there's some dude with a gun running around. But this guy sounds like he doesn't understand it. He's out there shooting his mouth off and spreading crap, which makes all the Ambos look bad. And I think, as the rest of you have said, that maybe we aren't sort of on TV going, this guy's a dick, but...
Thanks for ruining my clean tag 2 weeks in a row. Ben Hoffman, everybody. No,
nice drop of applause for Ben.
No,
Ben,
but you're right.
My hero.
But he's right, though. I mean, Where is the AMR guy saying, you know, that's not safe, and here's the reasons why, and we're not cops, we don't have a gun, and we're not wearing Kevlar. So we're not going in until the guys that do the Blue Canaries really run in and make sure that the scene's safe. And That's what should be going on there.
I like the thing too was a description though of armed defenders.
Yeah. Oh well. Wait, man. Look, even our cops don't have guns. Our cops' guns are locked in a safe in the supervisor's car. But we have the armed defenders squad, and these are the dudes in the black Suburbans who roll up in the Nomex helmets and the black Kevlar with the automatic weapons. Okay, these guys are good. These guys are good.
Right.
That's most of the gangs up here in the Northeast, man. They got the same thing.
Nice, man. Nice. So is it hard to tell the cops and the gangs apart?
The gangs have Kevlar red bandanas and Kevlar blue bandanas.
Generally, the gangsters have greater firepower than the police.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so I think we've annihilated that topic enough. So,
I'm defeated.
No, Ben, you're done. You can't call people that name enough tonight. There's more.
Oh, sorry, man. I keep on pushing the mute button.
It's all right. Hey, so Tim, you had a topic this week that popped up on the NAEMSP website, which is the National Association of EMS Physicians, and it was talking about pain control. You want to talk about that one?
Yes, they have a Google Groups that is moderated by Mick Gunderson, and if you want to participate, you send him an email, you identify yourself and your affiliation, and you can contribute to the discussion. If you just want to read along, you can do that. They have Dr. Bledsoe, Dr. Wesley on there, also have had a bunch of bloggers participating. I'm drawing a blank on who was there. Mark Lenkors is one of them. Tom Boudelet from Pre-Hospital 12 Lead ECGs. And, you know, there are a lot of people participating with an interesting discussion of pain management. The one thing that you don't see is anybody saying that we're too aggressive with pain management. The closest I saw was somebody citing the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report showing that opiate overdoses were increasing a lot. But that's not due to EMS. So you have a lot of doctors talking about different treatments, different ways EMS should be doing this. And one important thing is the question about what to do about drug seekers. And pretty much everybody had the same response. It's not our job to be trying to figure out who's a drug seeker. There is absolutely no research that shows how to identify drug seekers. And it seems that the more experienced the medics are, the worse they are at identifying drug seekers, because they're basically more jaded and more likely to suspect everybody of just faking it. Definitely worth reading. And there's a lot of research available at the site if you want to read the studies that people are talking about.
So, what do you,
management always,
go ahead, Chris.
It always seems to give, you know, paramedics a little trepidation when they have to do pain management, and that's one of the things that we've always tried to. I've tried to work with to have them give more, you know, better pain. I know that, you know, I'm a cluster headache, migraine headache sufferer. I'll tell you what, I can't get that morphine on board sometimes. And I have to try to remind people that, you know, pain is real. And we can't sit there and we can't, you know, diagnose what's fake and what's phony. And but there seems still just to be a lot of trepidation, just a lot of nervousness of giving, whipping that pouch open and giving morphine or fentanyl or those drugs that are necessary. And I really don't understand the reason why. And that's something I think education is really important for our paramedics to understand that it's a necessity.
Well, but why do you think that is, though, Chris? I mean, at least from my side, I look at it from the time when I was in paramedic school. It was almost like it was a taboo to give anything, you know, people never died of pain, so you can, you know, they don't need pain management. You know, this is just for people that are wussies. And I think
proves that nobody ever died of pain.
Well, it's true. Nobody ever died of pain.
Ask anybody who says that, ask them to prove it. I'm willing to test their limits and find out just how much pain they can put up with before they die.
Dude, that's sick.
Well, the idea that the patient should just put up with the pain because nobody ever died from pain, that is a much more sick attitude, and it's something that people will listen to and they'll believe it, and they'll say, yeah, we don't have to treat pain. There is nothing wrong with torturing somebody by bouncing them along on a backboard on the rear axle of a truck on potholed streets, you know, on the way to the hospital, probably with the lights and sirens going and swerving all over the place. Yeah. Why not do that to somebody who was already in pain and that's why they called us? Make it worse. Make it 10 times worse. Yeah, your sure. pain was 10 out of 10. Now it's 100 out of 10.
It seems that.
Just one thing, real quick. Tim scares me. Sorry. Sorry. He scares me a little bit. That's all. Chris, go ahead.
You know, it seems that we're good at giving pain management to the people, you know, the old woman who's broke her hip, and before we put her on a scoop, you know, we're getting orders and we're taking care of that pain. But it's kind of that gray area that we just don't know, you know, and maybe it's not a narcotic. Whatever happened to the days of going to the dentist and getting some good old nitrous oxide, maybe we need to get those in the rigs and start using that for our pain management. There's a lot of good research out there that supports that, and I would be happy to be the first one to kind of try it out to see if it works. But
yeah, I think you got to look at that. I mean, you've got to work with your patient. you've got to work with your patient on everything. And I'm all for pain relief. And I've kind of gone into more of an aspect of starting to work with my patient, talking to them and seeing what their needs are, seeing where their pain level's at. Some people would actually just rather, for the meantime, go without it. Say, hey, it's here if you need it. I have it. I've also found that something lately I've been looking at is you have a lot of people, and I was one for doing this, where we're, you know, you get the patient on the floor with the broken hip, that, you know, you're putting the line in, you're getting the morphine on, and taking time to set in, which I was all for. But I found that getting them onto a top deck or getting them onto a soft stretcher, just getting them off the floor, reduced their pain significantly. Again, non-study, but just, you know, anecdotal, is found that that was a major relief of the pain, just getting them off the linoleum, getting them off that fractured or dislocated hip.
Well, the other thing, Kyle, I can go along with what you're saying there, is instead of starting the line and such, is give a little, shoot it up that way. You give them a few seconds as you're moving them, and then you're not worrying about getting blood on the carpet from starting an IV or anything like that, and it works great. It's easy, and then you get them out into the rig, and you do the rest of your treatments.
I'm sorry, Brad, you broke up. Were you saying I am?
Intranasal, IM.
Oh, intranasal. Yeah, see, unfortunately, we don't have the intranasal. We have the potential for doing IM. I've done IM, but I found especially with the geriatric population, the IM doesn't work as well. I don't know what your findings
are. IM is not a good way to go with pain management.
I really like the idea
intranasal,
of...
Intranasal, yes. Sorry.
I really like the idea of the nitrous oxide. That's something that I really wish that we would carry, at least in our area. And one of the things we were talking about, you know, why are we not as willing to hit people with pain management right away? And I can speak from people that I know who are just now becoming paramedics. They're scared to death of the narcs. They're scared that, you know, that the DEA or somebody's going to come knocking on their door, you know, wanting to know why they gave this patient morphine. And, you know, I'm not saying that I'm not saying that at all, but that's their perception, at least to me, when they're talking about this, is they're like, you know, they're worried about it because it's under lock and key about giving it.
It's some of the safest medication we have.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing I always get people is they're like, well, he has a head injury. I mean, flight medicine, you really got involved in terms of dealing with patients with fractures, you know, especially with, chest injuries or rib fractures, that they're hypoventilating because of the pain. But, ooh, don't give him any pain meds because he's got a potential head injury. It's like, well, give him the pain meds. I mean, they're going to see TM anyways.
Is it better to have him thrashing around and increasing his intracranial pressure,
exactly,
or to give him a little medication and keep it under control?
Exactly, and that's what a lot of people don't understand.
And a lot of them are doctors, which is surprising.
Yeah, Tim, I agree. It's very unfortunate. A lot of them are doctors that are holding us back with doing proper pain management on our patients.
And the other thing is
that's why I think it's a...
Go ahead, Chris.
And I think that's why it's important to have a good medical director that gives us those protocols that will allow us to make decisions and operate in the back of those units to help deliver this pain, to help deliver this management of pain. Because it's when you get those doctors on the phone and say, Doc, this is what I got, this is how they're presenting, this is their history, these are their vital signs, I like to give them a little something for pain. They're saying, you know what, just bring them in. Okay, Doc, well, thank you for letting me treat the patient. But if we can have protocols that are going to be supportive enough that we can make those decisions, because there's a lot of times when I knew that I wasn't going to get orders for medication, that I wasn't calling in a report to the hospital because I knew who was on at the hospital, and I knew they weren't going to give me the order to give the morphine. And it's the patient that suffers.
Well, what about telling the doctor, okay, I'll run that by the patient and see what the patient wants to do, and maybe the patient will want to go to a hospital where I can get orders. It is informed consent. It's not doc shopping. The problem is that we have a bunch of unpredictable responses when we call for something that should be very predictable. You've got pain, you get treated. But you call one doctor, you get one response. You call another doctor, you get another response. You call a third doctor, you get a third response. It's completely unpredictable unless you're familiar with the doctors and you know what kind of mood they're in that day.
I have to think they're a little gun-shy because I think most of the problems when you start running into problem with pain management is providers giving large doses all at once. And I think that's the issue. I'm a big proponent of smaller doses more frequently. As a matter of fact, when I consult with my physicians, you know, when I consult with the physicians, I'm out there and say, listen, I want to give them 5 milligrams as necessary as long as they remain hemodynamically stable. And I've yet to be turned down on that order. And it works.
Well, sometimes you get turned down, sometimes you don't. But you tell the doctor you're going to call somebody else if the patient says, I don't want to go there, if they're not going to treat my pain. Maybe they don't want it getting around to the other doctors that they don't have a set. And when has anybody ever heard of a patient having a bad outcome from EMS opiates?
If I could just hop in for a second, one thing I'm quite interested in asking you guys is you may want to hang me up after this, but do you feel that you guys have adequate options for analgesia? And before you answer, here in New Zealand, we have Entonox, which is nitrous oxide, at our entry to practice level. Our paramedic officers have morphine. Our intensive care paramedics, so advanced life support, have morphine plus midazolam and ketamine. And it's all autonomous. We don't need to ring up and ask anyone for it. There's no online control. So do you guys feel that you have adequate options for analgesia? Because I've seen your some protocols. It's like, well, you can give 2 milligrams of morphine and then another 2. And then you got to ring up for it. And it's just like, dude. Is it still 1990?
Well, you know, what's almost scary is that if you think about a pediatric dose for morphine, at some points it could be 5 to 10 times more the dose for the exact same, if you did it pound for pound or kilo for kilo for an adult patient. So that tells me we're probably underdosing our adult patients by quite a bit. I remember one time the medical director called me in his office. I was a new paramedic and I gave a guy that was 260 pounds. I gave him 5 milligrams of morphine in one dose. And he's like, oh, you got to be careful with that. I'm like, yeah, the guy was still screaming. What should I have done? He's like,
that's respiratory depression right there. He's screaming.
Like, yeah, I'm like, seriously, doc? He's like, well, you know, the protocol says 4 and then you got to call. I said, that's the craziest protocol I've ever heard of. I said, why can't I titrate to his pain? And then when I've given him too much, I'll back off. And he didn't. I was kind of a smart-ass paramedic at that point. But anyway.
And a lot has changed.
Glad to see you've improved.
Yeah, you know, I've improved. Now I'm on the internets with all those tubes and whatnot, telling people how I think.
Do you want to call that doc anything that begins with a D and ends in ick?
I won't tell you what his real name was. So, no, I won't. That's fine. Thank you.
So, the answer to my question would be no, then.
No.
I think it depends on a system, Ben. I mean, I think that's... Yeah, some protocols are very very liberal. They let you, in the system that I recently came from, we had the opportunity to give fentanyl, we had morphine, we had Versed, we had Valium. I mean, we had a lot of things at our disposal. But then as you look at some other protocols, some of the other medical directors are very, let's say, tight with it, and you don't have the opportunity to utilize as you do in some systems.
No, that's fine, and I appreciate there is a lot of variation. You're a big country, and there's a lot of places in between New York and Los Angeles and that place called America that people just forget exist, and you end up there at strange laundromats at 1 o'clock in the morning, and you think, oh, my God, how did I end up with it? Anyway, sorry. We're not here to hear my travel experiences. I was just curious, that was all, because we have a lot of in Australasia, all the services have ketamine, and it works really well, and I've seen some good results with it. We also have a lot of combination analgesia, things like midazolam and morphine or fentanyl, and I think we might be replacing morphine with fentanyl, which means we may get intranasal fentanyl, but a lot of my friends who are US ambos, they go, I can give like a milligram of morphine and then all I've got is morphine. It's like, well, that's really sad. So I was just curious, that was all.
Okay, I guess somebody
else. The protocols in the US are not at all consistent, and even when you find a place that has a good selection of medications, they may not have standing orders for those medications, while someplace else may only have morphine and Valium, but have aggressive standing orders for them. So it's a real shotgun effect, a little bit of everything everywhere.
You know,
It's not just nationwide, even within a state, between counties, cities, agencies, and all the protocol differences. And you can have five or six agencies operating in the same metro area, each with different protocols, each with a different set of circumstances, each with different medical directors. And not to defend the ER, but at times for them that can become a little confusing on what one service can and can't do.
Why should it matter? If you're getting a doctor's order, you follow the doctor's order, even if the protocol says that it's wrong. You have the ER doc tell the medical director, hey, I gave the order for that amount of medication, so there's nothing wrong with your medics giving it under a doctor's order.
No, Jim, I don't agree with that at all. Calling in and doing a request, what I was stating is actual standing orders and what some services can or can't do.
Yeah, I am fortunate. I've got pretty good standing orders, although they don't include abdominal pain and head injuries, but I also have a good selection of medication. So when I go into Philadelphia, the ERs are a little bit surprised at what I've done on standing orders compared to what Philadelphia has done. We're in the same state. We've got statewide protocols, but any medical director can make them more restrictive if they want to, which, they shouldn't be a ceiling. They should be a floor.
That's true. And I suppose my question was really whether or not you felt that in those systems which they only had morphine, for example, whether or not you felt you had adequate options to treat your patient's pain. We went to this lady one night, the hip fracture on the floor. I believe she got up to 10 or 15 of morphine, and then that didn't work, so she got some ketamine. And that worked really well, and I've just seen it work wonderfully. It's a wonderful, it's really, really good. So I was just curious as to whether or not you guys felt that you had adequate options to treat your patient in that severe, irretractable pain where your morphine's not doing anything and it's unlikely to respond to traditional narcotic analgesia.
I guess my question that I ask you, though, on that is, I mean, you're waiting for a lot of time, she's in excruciating pain. Would it have been easier to pull off the Band-Aid faster? I'm all for pain medication, but, it's not working. Maybe we should just try to get her off the floor and get her into a more comfortable position, on that. I mean, was any attempt made of that?
Yes.
I generally try to move them before I give them medication and to find out just what is going to work best for the patient, because it's about what is best for the patient, not what's best for us, not what's best for the medical command doc, and not what looks good on the paperwork. And generally, once you start moving them, they start screaming. Then I say, okay, if you're not screaming while you're lying here, but you're screaming when I try to move you, I'm starting a line, I'm giving some medication.
I had a lady just the other day. She was screaming on the floor, screaming on the floor. It hurts. It's driving into my hip. It's driving into my hip. So I looked at her and said, all right, and just rolled her up, got her off the hip, and the pain went tremendously away. And I mean, I've kind of gone different routes in my career where I'm, you know, oh, I don't want to touch the morphine. Oh, let's give it like water. Oh, maybe let's look at it and see. And starting to look now and looking at our patients and going, okay, what do they need? What's best for them? Working with our patients, talking with them, because especially with the elderly, you start giving them some of these medications, and you're right. I mean, the possibilities, or I should say the statistics are low, but, you know, you are altering the body. You're giving a medication that can alter the body. Yes, we can take it away in most instances.
Same with dextrose and amiodarone and lidocaine.
I agree with you, Tim. I agree 100%. Anytime we give a medication, including oxygen, maybe we'll get into that one later, we're altering the body, and we have to, you know, really think about it. We should just not be pushing drugs just because, well, we can.
I think one of the big things that we often forget is just simple patient positioning and packaging. I see a lot of times patients come into the ER and there's voids on the board that aren't padded, and you know, the patient's in pain, and it's like, why didn't we pad the voids? Why didn't we get them into a position of comfort instead of just sticking them on the board, strapping them down, and going?
And I mean, that's a whole other thing. I mean, I think spinal immobilization is probably one of the worst skills that we do in our career field. And when I say the worst skills, it's the one we take for granted the most. It's the one that we can, we need to do a better job at. I mean, I walk around and see people, they don't even size the cause, but that's a whole other conversation. But when it comes to dealing with our patients, we really have to take them into account when it comes to the care that they deserve. You know, again, do we really consider our patients to be? How many times have we heard it? Treat your patients like your family. If that was my wife laying there, I'd want her to get some morphine. If it was my ex-wife, I'd want to put it right on the board and I'd give her anything. But we have to be able to take care of our patients' needs, and we've got to be able to give them the medications they need, whether it's lidocaine, whether it's amiodarone, whether it's morphine or fentanyl. We really have to do a better job at it.
So, and Kyle had said something earlier. It's like, yeah, we won't intubate. And I think, I'm going into intubation. Sorry. We won't immobilize. And I think that our career field eventually will go down to this idea where we won't be doing the eyes so much. We won't be doing the intubation. We won't be doing the immobilization. We'll be doing other things that will support the care of the patients that we're dealing with. And I am all in favor of doing what's right for the patient. And I agree with Kyle that you ask the patient and you do what's right. Would you like a little pain meds? No, I'm fine in this position. Okay, then let me know if this starts hurting. Oh, gee, you're screaming and no position is comfortable for you. Let's give you something so that you kind of forget about that. Oh, and let's also give you something so you really forget about it called, Valium or Versed, so that, at the same time, your pain is not the most memorable experience of this whole transport to the hospital. So I agree that we really need to do something different in our industry to make sure that why aren't we more like the hospitals where we're really controlling people's pain versus we're afraid of it and we're really genuinely trying to protect people from the things we can actually do. And I do agree with Tim. Although I don't think that pain ever killed anybody, I do think that pain is one of the most uncomfortable things that we encounter that we can really save people from. And it's something that we can do and effectively do to help patients be more comfortable. And
we don't do a good job.
I agree.
We don't do a good job of initial education. So you've got people coming out of medic school and they don't know what is an appropriate dose. They don't know what is aggressive, what is not aggressive, what is torture. Yeah. If we took people and rotated them through, say, a burn unit, they would get an experience of seeing people with significant pain being treated with aggressive and very high doses of fentanyl, morphine, Dilaudid, and have a much better understanding of titrating the medication to what the patient's feeling.
Well, and I think that's the other thing is in paramedic school that we really don't get a lot of education in is what is an appropriate dose. But not only what is an appropriate dose, but what is too much? And when do we approach that? I mean, for some people, 10's a lot. 10 milligrams of morphine is a lot. For some people, 10 milligrams of morphine is barely going to touch it. And so I believe in titration. Titrate to your patient and titrate to the effect of what their pain is. And be allowed to give what you need to make them comfortable. And, you know, I'm not an advocate for dumping the whole entire bucket into them all at once, because then you got to deal with like airway management and, well, the patient's a bucket, really. I mean, think about it. But I'm a big advocate.
Do you have to deal with airway management?
Well,
have you ever had to deal with airway management on a patient you've aggressively treated with any opioid?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I come from the land of orthopedic injuries, and in Summit County, we carried morphine by the 50-gallon bucket full. So, yeah, there have been times where you adequately snow a patient where you're like, we should probably, you know, bag this patient for a couple minutes just to make him happy again. And, yeah, now would I call that aggressive airway management where I have to intubate them or do something? No, but I mean, where I want to make sure that the patient's not going to choke on their own vomit. Yeah, I would want to make sure, or snore on their own tongue. Probably a good idea. But am I going to reverse what I did with Narcan? No, because I know very quickly that patient's going to reverse from that episode. And if I give them a little oxygen, open their airway, and just give them a couple minutes, they're going to be fine. And they're going to sleep well. And they're not going to feel their pain. And that's what that's about.
That was morphine?
Yeah.
Well, if it's morphine, maybe all you needed to do is just talk to them. Give them a little extra oxygen, and it would have had the same result, because the morphine is still not hitting peak effect most of the time. I don't know what your transport times were, but the morphine's not hitting peak effect till half hour, 45 minutes after you've given it.
Guess what our transport times were from Summit County to Denver? 65 minutes. And there you go. No, but you're right. I mean, and most of the time, and I'm talking about the times where, you know, I just didn't give a little chest rub or just kind of flick their eyelids and go, hey, you awake there, buddy? When everything else didn't work. So, yeah, I mean, there were a couple times in a few years where that occasionally happens. And, you know, again, it's not a medication error. It's that the patient over time is developing enough of this backup of all the drugs that you just kind of go, okay, you know what? Okay, maybe I gave them maybe we've aggressively managed their pain enough. And that's okay. I mean, but that's okay because they were happy. And boy, by God, you know, but here's the deal. But I believe that most people don't know when you're killing them, but they know when you're being mean. So I'm always nice to people, even when I'm killing them. So no, I'm teasing. I'm not killing anybody. I'm just teasing.
You know, I think the other thing is that I've heard it mentioned here several times about the patient writhing in pain, writhing in pain. Patient does not have to be writhing in pain to be in pain. Right. There are a lot of very stoic people out there, and you ask them, what's your pain level? And they tell you it's 9 out of 10. And I see paramedics look over the monitor, well, his heart rate's only 80. Yeah, because he's on beta blockers, you knucklehead. You know, and they don't think about these things. If the patient says they're in pain and they're hurting, they don't have to be crying. They don't have to be hypertensive. They don't have to be tachycardic. If they say they're in pain and they want something for pain, we should be treating that pain. Just because they don't have to be writhing. And, you know, I think we have a lot of people in this industry that wait for the patient to be writhing, or we interpret the monitor, and you got to look at everything. And again, work with your patient.
Wow, Kyle, you hit the nail on the head. Ask your patient.
Definitely.
Gee, how hard is that?
You know, and Kyle brings up a good point. He goes, "What's one person's pain as another person's sadistic evening?" And you know, you really have to.
Well, Kyle really said that.
Well, that's what I got out of it.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, because somebody has a high threshold. I mean, I go to the dentist as soon as I open the door. I want a shot. You know, I've got a friend of mine who goes to the dentist. He doesn't even take Novocaine.
And, what kind of shot, though?
He doesn't even feel it.
Or?
I don't care what it is. Right. That's exactly. As long as I get through the door, as long as I'm starting to feel no pain. But, you know, one person's, pain tolerance, we really have to take that into effect. And that's the problem problem when we find in our protocols when they say 2 to 4 milligrams of morphine to a max dose of 10. You know, it really has to go to the individual. It's not going what the doctor thinks they should have. You know, give me a max dose and let me work it for them.
Well, every year I have a couple patients who get 20 milligrams or more of morphine or 200 micrograms or more of fentanyl. So a maximum of 10 is going to, you know, not be enough for a lot of my patients, because you also have some who don't even get to 20 or 200. The tachycardia that Kyle was talking about is something that only matters when you see it. If it's there, it's often an indicator that the patient's in pain, but if it's not there, it doesn't mean that they're not in pain. And there's an article in, I think it was JAMA, by Dr. Faisman. They posted it at the NAEMSP discussion called Truth Hurts, in which what he does is he takes a resident who's telling him he thinks the patient's a drug faker, puts the hand under some ice water, and says, "Tell me when that hurts." He's got him hooked up to the monitor, so he's looking at his heart rate and blood pressure and everything else, and he's showing him, they're not changing. You're in pain, but your vital signs have not changed. You're not on a beta blocker. You have no medical history that would cause bradycardia or anything like that, but you're not having the response that you say should be there, and because it's not there, that's why you're denying pain medicine to this patient.
So we, but don't we all agree that we don't treat the monitor, we treat the patient, right?
I agree. I think that was the point that he was making, that the tachycardia is only an indicator that the patient is experiencing pain. The lack of tachycardia is not an indication that the patient is not experiencing pain.
Okay. But
and see, there's another thing that I linked to in that discussion. It's another podcast. Don't want to give you guys a bad name, but it's a doctor out of someplace in California, an Edward Gentile on MCRIT, and he's talking about pain management, and his approach is just keep giving them morphine until they say they don't want anymore.
Whoa! There's other podcasts other than ours.
Oh my goodness!
Didn't know that. Sorry. Okay.
It was California, though, he said.
Oh, California. Oh, that doesn't matter. That's a different place.
Yeah, it doesn't count, right?
Yeah, that doesn't count.
Right. Whole different world.
Amen to that, brother. Well, you know what? We need to wrap this puppy up because we're getting really close to the end. Last ideas, thoughts.
It's only half as long as the last one.
Well, no, it's not quite half as long, but it's definitely about 37 minutes shorter than the last one. thoughts or this last little golden nuggets about pain management before we go. Okay. Hearing none. That's fine. And I'm okay with that. You know, I'm a big guy. So join us next week when we come to EMS Expo at the Zoll podcasting booth. If you're interested, come to Dallas, Texas, where it'll be at the Dallas Convention Center. The 27th, 28th through the 1st or 2nd. I don't know. We'll be there quite a while. And if you're really bored, you can come out and hang out with us at the blogger meetup on Wednesday night, or at the GEMS barbecue, or no, sorry, EMS Expo barbecue on Thursday night. So the GEMS blogger meetup Wednesday night, or the EMS Expo barbecue Thursday night. I know I'll be there. Jamie Davis will be there, the pod medic, Kyle David Bates, and I'm sure Brad Buck will be there because I'll drag him along with me. I'm sure Chris will be there and a few others. So come on by and join us. Chris, tell us where people can find you.
Recently, I started my world of Twitter. So Chief of EMS at Twitter, be happy to share some thoughts with you.
Very cool. And you're going to be at Expo next week so people can get your autograph.
I'm more than happy to do that.
There you go.
I'll sign whatever I need to sign to be for my fans.
Will you sign my breast? I'm just teasing.
I sure will. Okay. You want me to do that again, though?
Again? I have to throw up right now.
I love you, Chris. You're awesome, brother. All right, Ben, where can people find you?
I'm in bed sleeping for work tonight.
Okay, but other than that, like online, we really don't want to find you in bed. But where can we find you online?
You mean people want to find me? I'm worried.
Maybe. Yeah, they're stalkers.
Yeah, I'm going to back away slowly down on my contact. On Facebook,
yes,
man.
Which laundromat can we find you at?
Oh, dude, you have to hear my laundromat. Oh, my God. It was just so funny. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, but I don't know my Twitter thingy. I'm also at nhoffman25@gmail.com. If you just want to email me and go, hey, dude, which laundromat are you at next? And I'll so meet you there.
I'm just impressed that you come to the U.S. to do your laundry and then head home.
Whoa,
it's because
yeah.
We have downy softness in our laundry.
Yeah, it's, oh, God.
Oh, wow. Tim Noonan, where can people find you?
When I get the mute button, rosemedic.com and paramedicine101.com. And that was the blog that I was forgetting to mention. Adam Thompson also contributed to the NAEMSP discussion, and he was the one who pointed it out to me. So sometimes writing over there, sometimes just at Rogue Medic, and I've been on a bunch of podcasts lately.
Well, we love having you on, so thanks, Tim. Mr. Kyle.
Yeah, thanks for having
Mr. Kyle David Bates is going to lose at darts next week. Where can people find you?
You know, I'm already getting email from Anne saying how she's going to beat me. She's been emailing me for the whole podcast.
That's
here.
Awesome.
You know, but I'm trying to give her a better offer.
There's no way.
Yeah, I'm just going to play the, coming behind and take your team out from beneath you.
Uh-huh. Anyway, where can people find you?
They can find me at Image Medic for Twitter, KyleDavidBates.com, or over at my other project, The Other Podcast, which is a part of the radio network, EMS Radio Network, FirstFewMoments.com, Managing the Scene. We'll be down there recording as well, so stop on by.
And very soon, what's ever happened to the PDcast and the PDU?
PEDI-U, which right now is just kind of in limbo right now. His website is up and ready, just a lot of placeholder text. I'm hoping, I'm crossing my fingers, but Dr. Lou Romig is going to help me out with that for a little bit to record that. We're going to be recording our first session in mid-October. And our other one, EMS Eduzine, should be rolling out here shortly.
Very cool. And you can find all those on the emsradio.com website. Been working on that all week, and you can go there. And we actually now have a player that will play all of our old podcasts right there on the website. So if you don't really know what it's about, go to emsradio.com. James Warmoth, where can people find you other than sleep deprived from a new baby?
They can find me at yellowrubberducky.squarespace.com.
Have you put a new picture of the baby up yet?
Actually, I have a picture of the baby up on my MySpace page. Yes, I still use MySpace.
Whoa. What's MySpace?
I have not put one on that. I have not put one on my main directory page, no.
Do you have a band that you want to promote on MySpace? Like Yellow Rubber Ducky Band?
No, I don't have a
band.
Do you
have 8-tracks?
It's funny you mention that. I do have 2 or 3 8-tracks laying in the back room, believe it or not.
You know, I actually have an LP player and LPs. Ooh. But I'm just saying, but they sound really good. There's nothing wrong with that. Well, thanks, James. David Koenig, where can people find you, sir?
I'm on Twitter at David Koenig. It's not just about me. I would recommend everyone go over to emsblogs.com, check out all of the great bloggers over there, including the great Rogue Medic, who is public enemy number one to Google and Twitter and all of the social media services. We just announced paramedicine101.com this week, and we're going to be announcing 2 or 3 more bloggers who are joining us. And hey, if you want to join us in blogging about EMS, feel free to contact me. There's a form. Just make sure you put in what it is that you want to write about, as opposed to just sending me a blank form.
So you're saying that I didn't realize that Tim was the bad guy.
Yeah, apparently Google and Twitter woke up in the morning and they hated him this morning. So, you know.
They must have woke up on the wrong side of the bed.
I'm the antisocial medic and Dave is the social medic.
Well, right. Dude, yeah. That would be a sweet podcast. The antisocial medic. Where you could be grumpy about everything.
It
wouldn't matter.
I wouldn't have to change.
Oh, right. See, that should be your blog title, dude. Antisocial medic. Nah, I'm just saying. So it's probably already taken now because somebody heard it on the podcast. And
right,
I'm too lazy to go get the domain name. Brad Buck, where can people find you?
You can find me on Facebook. Search for my name. Twitter at CFMedic33, and my blog is now up and running. It is lifeupcloseandpersonal.blogspot.com.
CF33 is you? Wow.
You didn't know that?
Apparently not, no. Well, now I know. Well, and just because of this podcast, I followed you and Chris. So now we're following everybody on the podcast, so yay. Except Tim, who refuses to be social because he's anti-social.
And me.
Oh, well, and
Dave sends out Twitter updates for me.
Ah, very nice, very nice. Well, thank you guys.
He's that social, and I need it because I'm that antisocial.
Yeah, Dave even tells when he's out at the 7-Eleven getting a hot dog, which I love, by the way. Well, thanks for joining me. I am Chris Montero, Geeky Medic, and I actually am a little social. So join us next week when we're at EMS Expo. We'll be podcasting like 4,000 or 5,000 hours of EMS podcasting excellence from the show floor. We're near the food booth. So if you're following the food, come to our booth. We're actually right across the lane from the food, which is probably going to be good and bad. I think we'll get a lot of traffic because of it, but then I'll be hungry the entire time. So it'll work both ways. So if you're there and feel really sad for me because I haven't eaten all day, buy me a hot dog and bring it over. Take some Versed and fentanyl.
Because take your mind off the food.
At least I won't remember that I'm hungry. Right? Anyway, I'm Chris Montero. Thanks for joining us. Join us next week when we talk more about issues that concern you in EMS. Have a great day, night, weekend, whatever you're doing.